before I actually turn to my prepared remarks, I was gratified to see that so many people had prepared remarks, including Joe Stiglitz. I want to begin by also acknowledging another Stockholm Prize winner who's here, John Laub, who was formerly the director of the National Institute of Justice. So. I want to begin by thanking the Academy for bestowing this honor on me. It is both gratifying and humbling to be included among the ranks of scholars receiving the honor tonight and in the past. My award is in honor of Thorsten Sahlin, who was a pioneering criminologist who did path-breaking research that linked public policy to sound science. Following his example, I'd like to use my time tonight to speak about what good science has to say about U.S. criminal justice policy. For two decades, crime rates, particularly for violent crime, have been declining in the United States. And for an even longer period of time, four decades, prison populations have been rising throughout the country. 1% of our adult population is now behind bars. Across the political spectrum, there's a recognition that the social and economic costs of incarceration at its present scale is not affordable. Can incarceration be cut without triggering more crime? The answer is yes, but only if we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. More than 250 years ago, Cesare Beccaria, an Italian philosopher and politician, wrote extensively on crime, and he admonished, "It is better to prevent crimes than punish them." The U.S. response to crime, to rising crime rates in the 1960s and through the 1980s was predicated on two faulty assumptions that ignored Beccaria's warning. The first was that the police were impotent to prevent crime, and the second was that sending more people to prison for longer periods of time was an effective and efficient way to prevent crime. Conventional wisdom is that the certainty of punishment, not its severity, is the more effective deterrent. Evidence, though, gives us the correct form of the certainty principle, which is it's the certainty of apprehension, not the severity of the ensuing consequences, that is the effective deterrent. This conclusion has two important policy implications. First, it makes clear the fallacy of claims that punishments such as mandatory minimum sentencing deter crime. There is simply no evidence that increasing the risk of imprisonment post-apprehension and conviction serves as a deterrent. Likewise, there is good evidence that lengthy sentences are ineffective in deterring crime and not efficient ways of preventing crime by incapacitation. A just-released report from the National Research Council Committee on the Causes and Consequences of High Incarceration Rates, upon which I served, affirms both these conclusions. Mandatory minimum sentences need to be repealed and sentence lengths reduced to cut prison populations. Second, the revised certainty principle places effective use and deployment of police at center stage in deterring crime. There's much evidence that proactive policing methods, such as focusing police presence on crime hotspots, is effective in preventing, not just displacing crime. As we scale back on prison populations, it is important that we make more effective use of the police in a way that provides for safety in a democratic society, not a safe police state. Proactive policing tactics have potential negative consequences. Stop, question, and frisk, for example, has been the source of enormous controversy, not only in New York City, but also in other places around the world, largely because the people police are stopping, questioning, and frisking are often young, disadvantaged men. If stop, question, and is stop, question, and frisk effective in reducing crime? Evidence to answer this question is scant. In any event, that's the wrong question anyway. The right question is, we should be asking is stop, question, and frisk more effective than forms of proactive police, than other forms of proactive policing in preventing crime? There are good reasons for deep skepticism about the relative effectiveness of stop, question, and frisk, at least as practiced in New York, compared to other forms of stop, question, and frisk and proactive policing methods more generally. First, police effectiveness in responding to crime rests heavily on the willingness of citizens to report crime and identify perpetrators. Policing tactics that alienate communities reduce the willingness of its citizens to cooperate with the police. Second, stop, question, and frisk produces far too many arrests for minor offenses, such as the possessions of small amounts of marijuana. These arrests clog the court systems with trivial cases. They also needlessly scar the records of those who are arrested in ways that limit their future employability and expose them to increased legal risk. Proactive policing methods such as stop, question, and frisk need to have less noxious effects on communities. This requires that officers receive proper training on how to do proactive policing methods in ways that are respectful and minimize their impact if no weapon is found. Police also have to spend time explaining their initiatives to communities and telling them what they are doing and why. The crime drop of the last two decades has brought us incalculable benefits in terms of lives saved, freedom to enjoy public spaces, and the revitalization of cities. But the cost to society from incarceration and aggressive policing tactics are also enormously costly, not just in terms of economic cost, but human suffering. It is important that we implement policies that prevent crime rather than warehouse more people in prison to no effective end. So again, I want to thank the Academy for bestowing this honor on me. And I also want to thank my wife, Risa, for putting up with me for the last four decades.